will benefit others. Or, as more eloquently stated by the poet Charles Bukowski, the free soul is rare, but you know it when you see it. Basically, because you feel good, very good, when you are near or with them. Do we ever get to a place where we are stakeholder-free? I don't think so. We are a social species, and feedback is often an essential part of decision-making. Our stakeholders are an important part of our lives. Perhaps it seems like calling them stakeholders dehumanizes them, because at the end of the day, they love us, they support us, cry with us, laugh with us, fill us with happiness, anger, and a million other emotions. The key becomes honoring your spider senses while allowing these relationships to unfold and exist. Because with time, the beautiful thing that happens is that when you honor yourself, fight the good fight, take the chances, integrate the advice, but ultimately trust yourself, you model something very important for your stakeholders. Once they see you succeed and excel and shine, some of them will start taking those chances themselves. I think I have inspired more people to successful weight loss, not through my words, but through my life. Through not only a successful loss of 85 pounds, but by watching me take chances, make changes, honor my voice, face down my fears, and pursue my dream. In the short term, your stakeholders may recoil at your willingness to be you, and some may leave. But those who stay will have seen the authentic you and will learn through observation how to listen to their own beautiful voices. Advice on advice. The fact is, it's damned near impossible to give advice to someone without it being what we want for ourselves. Thus, when you ask for advice, remember that most likely the other person is telling you what they would do for themselves, not necessarily what is best for you. This can make for some tricky business, because we can often talk ourselves out of what we know is truly right for us. Here's an example. I have a friend who was really working hard at losing weight. She had curbed her calories, especially when it came to alcohol. She worked in an office that often gathered for drinks after work. She joined her regular gang, and when her friend asked her if she wanted a second martini, she said no, she'd have club soda. That's good decision-making. It was hard, but she did it anyway. She decided club soda was a better choice, because a second martini meant more calories, and probably mindless eating to follow. Her friend wasn't cutting calories, although she should have been, but as a stakeholder, she wanted a partner in crime. The not-on-a-diet-right-now friend crossed her arms and said sulkily, "Fine, I won't have another one either." But with that, my friend caved in to her guilt and joined her for another cocktail. The why. Taking on stakeholders is tough, which is why I remind patients of the wide range of responses available to them, from walking away to learning how to work around them while honoring their spider senses. Many times I have looked at a scenario from the outside and reflected on the fact that if we could just get distance between the patient and a specific family member, or just eliminate the relationship altogether, we would make quantum leaps. But evaporating human relationships is not that simple, and so the task becomes one of figuring out how to help clients find ways to integrate stakeholders into their lives in a way that facilitates growth and allows their spider senses to blossom. Part of taking them on is identifying them and their role in your life. It helps you to organize yourself and lets you be on alert when you interact with certain kinds of stakeholders. If you can be mindful when you encounter your different kinds of stakeholders, you will be better prepared to keep your spider senses on point. Some stakeholders are people we have known all our lives, and some are strangers. They are also the messages we receive from the world, advertisers, and television. Living to please is like living a half-life. In my years of working with clients with disordered eating and weight problems, and from my own story of weight loss, I've learned that one thing is clear. People who struggle with weight also struggle with the desire to please others. Food is often consumed in an interpersonal context. Our first lessons around food often involved eating to please. In many cultures, hospitality is expressed via overeating or piling on more food. Restaurants give oversized portions, and even though we don't know the chef or waitress, we eat to please them, or our dining companions. Pleasing others is hard work, and we often do it so we can feel in control of our environments. It gives us a way to organize our behavior, and it also teaches us to quiet our own instincts and respond to another's cues. Females in much of the world are socialized to please their elders, play cooperatively, obey their husband, and while feminism has made a dent in this, women and pleasing are still like two peas in a pod, and weight-related discontrol is still very much the province of women. If we eat to please, cook to please, and then, in the midst of this pleasing parade, feel so out of control that we also eat to soothe, numb, cheer up, shut down, and distract, food becomes a multi-purpose drug. An easy way to break that cycle is to stop eating for anyone but yourself. The food you eat nourishes you, fills you, and only you know what you want or when you have had enough. Just as no one else can tell you if you are hot or cold or tired or angry or happy, no one can tell you how and when to eat. The now. Grab your journal and a pen. This exercise is something you do over time, and I'm aware this list will keep growing. Step 1. Write down the names of the people who influence your daily life. People from your past. People who have influenced your decision-making during the last year. The people you turn to with good news and bad, or big-ticket decisions. Don't hesitate to go to your cell phone contacts, Facebook page, and address book, and pull names from there. What will be interesting is the order of the names. Make a note of whether a pattern emerges. For example, do more toxic stakeholders jump out at you initially? Do you list family members initially? Do you wait until later in your list to write down coworkers? Step 2. Beside each name, I want you to write down your relationship to each person in the list, and then define the type of stakeholder they represent to you. People can be more than one. For example, mom may be both heavy and toxic. Heavy. Daily. Circumstantial. Stranger. Toxic. Unconditional. Step 3. List the actual decisions they have each influenced you to make. For example, where you went to college, the car you purchased, who you married, where you live. Step 4. Relationship rating. This is completely subjective, but using a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is indicative of a relationship that you deeply value and is characterized by support, and 1 is a relationship that is abusive in any way, toxic and undermining, rate each relationship. You are your own reference here, but it will be important to note whether higher ratings are associated with people who allow your spider senses to flourish. Since this exercise is a work in progress, I want you to use it as a way to monitor change in how stakeholders affect your spider senses. Stakeholder Dictionary. When you make a big decision, whatever it is, make one of these lists for the people you spoke to about that decision. By doing this, you create a personal stakeholder dictionary. Stakeholder influences are so woven into the daily fabric of our lives that we often don't recognize where we end and they begin. Step one to fixing this is breaking down how they influence you and your spider senses. Chapter 3. The Not-So-Golden Rules. The golden rule is that there are no golden rules. George Bernard Shaw. What if we were to create a modern-day melange fairy tale for a girl in our society? Once upon a time, there was a gorgeous little girl. She was born into a loving family with a biological mother and father that loved each other very much. They lived in a big and beautiful home, and she was a wonderful student and a gifted musician and athlete. She had siblings, and all were happy and healthy. They ate all of the food on their plates and never complained. The girl attended an excellent university where she met and dated lots of eligible young men. She dated a particularly nice one during her last year. He was from a family just like hers, and went on to develop his career as she explored her career interests as well. Over time, they moved in together and decided to get married. He bought her a wonderful big ring, and they had a wonderful big wedding. He was a success, and she wanted babies, so she decided to stay at home in their beautiful home with their beautiful babies. And, of course, they lived happily ever after. Short of a glass slipper or a poisoned apple, isn't this how we think all stories should progress? And shouldn't they all end exactly like this? Now, let's really delve into Aesop and Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm and Disney and the fables our parents and grandparents and communities told us. Let's recall the epics and the fireside stories, the fairy tales of our youth that filled our heads with images of how things should be. Add the basic rules of order driven by commandments, mythology, and religion. Tales that were often told to us at bedtime, that we took into our dream worlds, and that set the tone for our fears, wishes, and lives. I must say that one of the most powerful stories for me was The Red Shoes. In this story by Hans Christian Andersen, a little girl from a poor family gets one new pair of shoes each winter. Because they can afford just one pair, she always gets the same brown leather ones. One year, she and her family walk in front of the store, and she sees a divine pair of red shoes. Beautiful, but simply unsuitable for the cold months and work ahead. Oh, but the young girl covets the red shoes, and since she loves to dance, she imagines how they would allow her to realize her dreams of dancing. She is a good girl, and so, on this year, her parents entrust her to go to the store with the hard-won money and purchase her shoes herself. She gets to the store, and the power of the red shoes is too much. She figures shoes are shoes, so she gets them. She wears them out of the store and finds that in these shoes she can dance more amazingly than she has ever danced before. She dances through the fields and meadows all the way home. But as she nears home, she finds that she can't stop. She keeps dancing right past her home and back to the store, but she still can't stop. As darkness falls, she gets closer to home and is nearly falling down with exhaustion. Her father, a woodcutter, looks down at her feet and sees what has happened. There was no way to take off the shoes, so he cuts off her feet and they go dancing off into the woods. The punishment for her hubris? A life without feet. I was terrified upon hearing that story as a child, but listen I did. right into adulthood. I was scared to death of breaking the rules, taking a chance, defying my elders, because then I might literally lose my limbs, or worse. Think of the lessons and teachings we learned from very early on. Never defy your elders. Remain quiet. Wait for fate to cast a hand. Honor duty. All of these lessons, like eat everything on your plate, are focused on order and control. I was raised on the even more heavy-handed tale of duty dictated by Rama and Sita in the Ramayana. Rama is forced into exile for a very long time. Nobody believes Sita will remain his devoted wife while he is gone, in part because nobody knew if he was even still alive. But Sita was devoted because Rama was her guy, so she lived her life in devotion to him throughout his exile. When he finally returned, he was named King of Ayodhya, and Sita his queen. It was known to the kingdom that temptations had been sent her way to test her throughout his exile, all of which Sita had withstood. When Rama went to take his throne, it was very important to the citizenry that their queen be pure, so they asked her to succumb to a test. Rama should have been a stand-up guy and told them that he knew she had been devoted, but as many do, he caved in to his stakeholders and sheepishly asked her to take the test. He told her that if she were devoted, then she would pass anyhow, and it would all be okay. She, of course, dutifully bowed her head and said, "Of course, my lord." The test required her to walk through fire. If she was pure, the fire would not burn her, and if she was sullied, well, then she would burn to death. She walked through the fire, and she lived, emerging unscathed. Rama breathed a sigh of relief, knowing she was devoted, and was ready to face the people with their new queen. Here's the problem, and they never told me this feminist postscript when I was young. After she passed the test, she left and returned to Mother Earth. She figured that he should have known her to be pure, and he should never have caved to the pressure of the stakeholders to make her prove her devotion. Sita was, in some ways, the original authentic feminist. But at the end of the day, this parable is about blind devotion and duty to stakeholders. The rules of duty and devotion still pervade much of what I do, and it's likely that commandments, fables, and myths about happily ever after still drive much of what you do. These childhood teachings were the first way we organized our lives. Writers, especially Bruno Bettelheim, talk about how fairy tales both frighten us and provide structure for our world. Childhood stories stick with us because they taught us how to organize our worlds, what to want, and what to think. Happily Ever After leads many a little girl to dream of a fairy tale wedding. In addition, our childhood myths gave us insight into how to please our stakeholders. And if children want to do one thing, they want to please, and they want positive regard. Those stories contained implicit messages about how to please the world, and while we are able to intellectually argue away the simplicity of these lessons, where the rubber meets the road, they still guide our thinking. Breaking childhood teachings is never easy, and in essence, they are like white noise that can sometimes stop us from listening to ourselves. Remember, it is easier to maintain the status quo than to make a change. Even if the status quo is awful, many people still choose to stay in it. If we are able to take the risk of acting in defiance of a golden rule or fairy tale, while acting in accordance with our spider senses, and then have a successful experience, that becomes an enormous brick in the wall of learning to honor our spider senses. Imagine being raised with the winners never quit line and the idea that success is measured monetarily. Then you decide to quit a financially plush but soul-numbing job at a prestigious firm because your heart, mind, soul, and spider senses are saying, run away. Despite every childhood teaching telling you otherwise, you do so. You pursue your dream that honors you but may not bring the money or prestige. You struggle, and then the dream is realized. Perhaps you don't get rich, but each day you awaken emboldened by the possibility. Each decision that follows from this one is less and less likely to be influenced by the golden rules. The first few breaks from the golden rules are hard because they feel like flying without a net. Then, once you get your wings and trust your spider senses, the freedom will feel like flying. One criticism I hear is, won't people just walk away from everything if they do this? If they stop listening to these golden rules? On the contrary, because they will be better decision makers or gatekeepers, they will be more likely to make good choices on the way in and be less likely to feel compelled to walk away or be conflicted and unhappy about the choices later on. Rewriting your fairy tale. As information streams into our world in new ways, the new progenitor of fairy tales in our world is the media, particularly reality television and the mountain of internet imagery. In some ways, at least in the food world, the lessons are trickier. Anorexic model on one billboard, 1,000-calorie burger on the other. Cupcake competition on one channel, plastic surgery transformations on another. Photoshopped images of impossible beauty next to supersized meals. The juxtaposition of food imagery is even more confusing than simple rules about clean plates, happily ever after, and not rocking the boat. What if the stories were re-rendered? What if the fairy tale read as follows? Once upon a time, a wee girl who grew up in the shadow of the palace found herself in a difficult life, caring for cruel stepsisters and a stepmother, and befriending the various rodents that populated her quarters. On the night of the big ball, a fairy godmother intervened and turned the dirty-faced girl into a dazzling specimen of womanhood. The young girl enchanted the prince, who fell in love with her. And when she dashed away at midnight, he vowed to use the shoe she left behind to find her. He did find her, and they married. She moved into the palace, and while he was doing his princely duties, she launched an initiative to ensure that no little girl would ever find herself in such a situation as hers. But her work increasingly pulled her away from the prince, and once they had children, they grew apart. Apparently, one night of dancing and a shoe hunt was not enough on which to build this relationship, and the princess realized that she was feeling curtailed by the bounds of her life. She and the prince went to counseling, but he was really looking for a different life than she was, and so, to honor herself, she suggested that they consider a break. My daughter recently asked, "Why doesn't Cinderella have a sequel?" It was a good question. Fairy tales often stop with the happily ever after, leaving us to muse on what ever after looks like. Even when modernist revisions attempt sequels, they still typically end up in a happy, committed place. And the tales rarely teach the harder lesson of when to cut bait. Famous investor Warren Buffett once said, "Should you find yourself in a chronically leaking boat, energy devoted to changing vessels is likely to be more productive than energy devoted to patching leaks." Rarely do the childhood lessons offer this as an option. The ones that stick are typically the ones that tell us to stick. Why are childhood lessons so sticky? If someone told me today, "Winners never quit," would it have such an impact? The lessons of childhood often stick with us because we took them on to please others, just like we would eat to please others. In fact, doing things to please others may be the most classical fairy tale we sell children. It makes sense. It makes the adults' lives and society's control easier if they can socialize children that way. And the fact is, we were socialized that way. So we continue doing it, generation after generation. So, the lessons of childhood are, finish everything on your plate. Winners never quit. Don't question your elders. The night is full of scary, unknown creatures. Avoid risk. Save for a rainy day. These lessons are powerful because we did these things to please parents, teachers, communities, and society. Take on the rules. We grew up learning and listening to these myths, fairy tales, and rules. It's time to start breaking them and stop letting them blindly guide the choices you make and the life you live and the food you eat. Let's take a look at them, one by one, and come up with a new and better set of rules. Quitters never win. Winners never quit. Remember this one? Now, look at the biographies of some of the most successful men and women in politics, science, technology, and media who sometimes quit, walked away, and stopped throwing bad money after good. Steve Jobs, Oprah Winfrey, Johnny Carson, Henry Ford, Bill Gates, Joe Kennedy, and Steven Spielberg, to name a few. Sometimes they failed, and people told them they were unfit for the work they wanted to do. Some left school. Some left successful TV shows. And nearly all of them said that they trusted their guts and pursued what felt right. Research by Timothy Judge, a professor at Notre Dame, has revealed that success may actually be a product of being able to choose the path to quit while moving forward on another path with conviction. We can get so buried in other projects and tasks that we forget to pay attention to the right path for us. So, even though the old saying says that quitters never win, research actually suggests otherwise. It's about knowing when and what to quit, so that you can pay attention to the better path for you. Perhaps the list we aren't as familiar with is comprised of the people who trusted their guts and may not have achieved success. In fact, they may have lost everything. But then, would the taste of regret be worse than not trying at all? While they may not be famous, I have spoken with several people who did take risks and quit a more conventional lifestyle to honor their spider senses, but did not achieve success. Not one of them termed the experience a failure, with most of them acknowledging that they felt good and brave about trying, and that they often reflected on the many lessons they'd learned. Quitter is such an ugly word because it implies lack of effort, laziness, and lack of determination. Sometimes a quitter is someone who listens to an inner voice and makes a choice. And sometimes they win, and win big. New rule, sometimes you have to quit to win. Don't talk to strangers. This is about the fear of what happens when we talk to the scary person who is different from us. Now, this lesson has some utility for kids who are suggestible. There are predatory people out there, and that childhood archetype of the villain hanging about with a bag of candy is an oldie but a goodie. In teaching children prudence, we often make them reticent, as kids and adults, to boldly share their thoughts and views with others. We, as humans, are already wired to gravitate toward people who are similar to us, and that can be limiting. Or we wait until we are in safe settings, meeting people at work, or at parties where everyone is somehow connected through school or the host. Talking to strangers, people who are unlike us, who just come out of nowhere, can harness things within us and lead us to opportunities that would not otherwise happen. Your spider senses often steer you right. If a stranger doesn't feel right, then don't approach. But sometimes that stranger who feels approachable could be worth the hello. Talking to strangers led me to my great love, to some fascinating travel opportunities, and some of my best life lessons. New rule. Say hello to one stranger a day. At minimum, you will brighten someone's day, and there is the possibility that you may change a life. Maybe your own. Fairy tale expectations. If we just blindly subscribe to fables and fairy tales, we will find ourselves making decisions that may reflect what Aesop, Walt Disney, and the Brothers Grimm want for us, but not what we know is best for us. Many times the golden rules and myths can set unrealistic or unhealthy expectations for a situation. Happily ever after. Don't fly too close to the sun. Patience is always a virtue. Duty always carries clear rewards. Clean your plate. Good things come to those who wait. Typically, this golden rule results in lost opportunity and lost time. Patience, that great childhood lesson. Patience is supposed to be a virtue. The American writer and satirist Ambrose Bierce calls patience a minor form of despair disguised as a virtue. Yet, most spiritual teachers and pundits, the Dalai Lama, Lao Tzu, Rilke, Mother Teresa, love patience. Is some of this quality necessary in life? Yes, you can't always run to the head of the line. But this teaching, that good things come to those who wait, often begets inaction and a drive to shelve hopes, dreams, and aspirations in the name of patience. Most of us know when it is time to just do it and stop waiting, but the big spider-sense scramblers of stakeholders and fear often paralyze us. And then, one day, we look back on years lost, with lots of accumulated waiting. Society loves patience because it quiets the dissatisfaction of the masses. By turning waiting into a good thing, it makes it easier for the existing structures to either take their own sweet time to create necessary change, or to not change at all. Too often, we convince ourselves to wait and put our heads down and work hard instead of trusting our guts and not waiting, but going for it. Never wait on a dream. New rule. Stop waiting and do it. Today. Fairy tales rule our world. Boy meets girl. Picket fences. Happily ever after. Everyone gets married. Notions like these can lead to poor decision-making and impact our gatekeeping, because we think we need to strive for certain fairy tale rules. Get along with everyone. Have you ever met someone and instantly the hairs on the back of your neck stand up? That's your spider senses kicking in and screaming at you. But instead of backing away quietly, what do? You listen to the replay of the voice of your kindergarten teacher, telling you that it's nice to give everybody a chance. That person, more often than not, will disappoint you time and time again. And even though you keep trying not to be judgmental, you need to remember that it is more than okay not to like everyone. Life is short, and spending time with people you don't like is not a good use of time. We have to do it enough at work and with our families. It might seem okay to tolerate everyone and to keep trying to get along with people, but by forcing yourself to sustain those relationships, you are bruising your spider senses in order to fulfill some summer camp fantasy that everyone needs to get along. This also plays into the rescue fantasy. Many times people will ignore spider senses and let someone in whom they feel can be helped or rescued. I'm a psychologist and I work with lots of people. I can say with certitude that no one can be rescued. A human being is not an engine that you rebuild. When you feel the freedom to walk away from people and situations, You'll also feel more empowered to walk away from plates. New rule. Don't throw bad money after good in any relationship. Give it a chance, but if it stops fitting or you stop growing in it, it's okay to let it go. Be seen, not heard. Ah, yes, the denial of a soul. The classic life lesson that tells you to silence yourself because you recall that the most virtuous child was the one who did not speak. I remember a trip to India when I was a child. Trips to India were often characterized by long, meandering visits to relatives with few distractions. There were no video games or iPad movies for me to watch then. I remember being told how wonderful I was for sitting silently for 2 hours in someone's house. It was awful, and the longer I did it, the longer I went unnoticed. By the time we went to the next place, the silence wasn't cutting it, and I let loose and began misbehaving. I went against my spider senses earlier in the day by just sitting silent, and then went against them later in the day by misbehaving. The better lesson for me would have been to be seen and heard throughout the day, so I could have better taken in the experiences around me. Consider this. In essence, my behavior in the evening was like an eating binge after a day of not eating. Obviously, listening is good, but silencing your voice so as not to rock the boat, upset stakeholders, or communicate clearly is not acceptable. By trusting your gut, you will often communicate your thoughts, hopes, and wants instead of silencing yourself and your spider senses. People can only be seen if they are heard, so speak out appropriately, clearly, and strongly. New rule. Sing loud and strong and be heard and seen. Trust your voice. Save your pennies for a rainy day. I have seen people destroy themselves in the name of this principle. Most financial advisors will tell you that you cannot save enough, and that this process of saving has to start young. The mandate here is often to postpone a lot of life in the name of saving, so that someday, when you are quite old and no longer working, you will have enough money to live. Now, obviously, there is some prudence to this. We live in a country where it is expensive and perhaps even downright dangerous to not have a health care or financial safety net when you are older, because Social Security benefits are often not sufficient and retirement benefits often do not provide enough during a time of life when health care costs increase and employment opportunities may be limited. That said, when exactly is one supposed to live? Again, what if you trust your gut? In general, most people who are free of problems that can impair financial decision-making, such as addictions, impulse control disorders, or other mental illnesses, are able to see the bigger picture and not just capriciously spend money. I will note that shopping is the new eating, and many people spend and shop for the same reasons that other people eat. However, the perceived virtue of saving instead of spending can often lead people to take on much harder lives. I have a friend who had a full-time job, as did her husband, and they had a large brood of children. This woman spent many years training in her specialized field, and she wanted to find a balance between working and having children. Her spider senses told her that if she took 10 years off to raise her children, she would not be able to stay in the profession she valued. So, despite the prohibitive cost, she and her husband retained a full-time child care person at home. I, foolishly, did not. And it really took a toll not only on me and my husband at the time, but on our children as well. She had no more money than I did. In fact, she may have had less. They borrowed and used credit cards, but she said, "My kids are small, and I need this help now. I may have the money in 15 years if I save it, but then I won't need her." At the end of each day, there was less stress for her and her husband. Today, they are still very happily married. Her children are succeeding brilliantly, and they are all very connected to each other. I remember repeatedly turning away wonderful opportunities to see the world when I was in graduate school, because I felt it was irresponsible, and I didn't have the money. I thought I shouldn't be taking a break from writing my thesis. I didn't want people to think I was irresponsible, and I was so wedded to my status as a starving student that I didn't take advantage of these opportunities. Ironically, as I went through my own journey, grew older, and learned to trust my gut, I would often embrace the fact that life is short, and somehow the bills would get paid. That kind of thinking has landed me on some low-budget, extraordinary adventures to Tibet, Peru, Greece, Italy, Spain, and other parts of the world. My spider senses told me the time was now, and a lifetime of experience reminded me that the bills eventually get paid. Today is the rainy day. I'm not saying start spending frivolously, but I am saying that every so often you should lift up your head, trust your heart, stop living for a day down the road, and take a fiscal leap. Interestingly, this lesson has fascinating implications for the dinner table. Many times we apply this thinking to eating. Instead of saving our pennies for a rainy day, we save our calories for dinner. It doesn't work that way. Yes, at a fundamental level, there are 3,500 calories in a pound. However, most people who starve themselves all day so they can eat more at night lose their ability to be effective counters. Binging often follows a day of deprivation, and we end up eating in a dysregulated way with the rationalization that, I didn't eat a thing all day. In addition, eating the majority of your calories in one sitting, especially later in the day, is not optimal from a metabolic standpoint, and the overly acute sense of hunger can throw off all of our spider senses around hunger, fullness, and portion size. Saving and eating are all about balance. Be prudent, but not austere. Saving all your money for a day down the road and not living now is a bit much, just like subsisting solely on steamed vegetables and never having that occasional but well-portioned indulgence could make for a rather bland life. New rule. Sometimes you need to act like the rainy day has arrived. Pride goeth before a fall. Women take this one too seriously. Don't toot your own horn, whether it's in the workplace or at home. I am on an interesting email list of women psychologists, and it's fascinating to observe how difficult it is for women to boast about their accomplishments, or even mention them. Women are taught, almost in utero, to not be prideful. And many an old wives' tale reflects on the fact that a prideful woman does not marriage material make. Many of us were raised on the evil eye. Say something good about yourself. Or even if someone else says something good about you. And that evil eye will seek you out, and you're toast. You can't give someone a swelled head by telling them they are good. Instead, it will actually build up their sense of efficacy, confidence, trust in their spider senses, and success. When you do something good and share such news appropriately, or if you feel good about your abilities and communicate that, your confidence and self-assuredness increases, as does your likelihood of a successful outcome. Denial of pride is at the core of so many difficulties with having a sense of self-worth and self-efficacy. Own your accomplishments. Learn how to share them appropriately, and welcome hearing similar statements from others. Often, we silence others' good news because it makes us take harsher measure of ourselves. The old saying, "Pride goeth before a fall," reflects false pride with little substantiation. It was Aesop's take on narcissism. But we have co-opted it, and any level of confidence is often viewed with suspicion. When we utter statements of pride, they are often followed by a pregnant pause as we wait for the other shoe to drop. Spider senses will usually allow you to accurately put those statements out at the right times. New rule. Perhaps pride begets success and goeth before a triumph. Dessert is bad for you. Everything is bad for you when you are consuming it for the wrong reason, and that includes dessert, or other kinds of food, or love. Most of us were taught that vegetables and other healthy foods are good, while dessert, cookies, and ice cream are bad. Our Calvinist culture tends to believe that pleasure is bad and struggle is good. Fun, bad. Hard work, good. Grilled chicken, good. Ice cream sundae, bad. Yet we are a country of pleasure junkies. Just turn on the TV and we're all scrambling to get our fix of sex, junk foods, and gambling. But pleasure and joy shouldn't be a fix. Instead, they should be a regular part of life, just as work or struggle is. As a result, when we are finally faced with pleasure, we often don't know how to regulate it, and those feelings of being out of control can sometimes lead us to either push it out or become somewhat secretive about it. Shame is very much at the core of eating disorders and substance abuse, and many other disorders where regulation is thrown off. Dessert shouldn't be misused as a reward or prize, or as something forbidden. Doing so gives it power, a bit like money. Our spider senses get thrown because we don't just view dessert as a food, but rather as something that means so many other things to us, and has since we were children. We've viewed a sweet treat as a celebration, an escape, a joy, or a cure for sadness for so long that we don't always trust our gut to let us have a little bit and move on, because it means so much more than just something that tastes good in that moment. Pleasure is good. Dessert is good. Fruits are good. It's about balance. New rule, pleasure and dessert should be a regular part of your life, not just a rare treat. Clean your plate. Since more than half of Americans clean their plates at the table, I think it's fair to say that this is the most classic and damaging food lesson. The Clean Plate Club is really at the heart of this book. I learned this lesson as a child, and then struggled with it right into my 40s. If you can't walk away from a plate of food when you are full, how are you going to be able to walk away from a relationship or marriage when it's done, or a job when it's wrong? We were taught to put our heads down and eat ourselves numb. And then one day we find ourselves putting our heads down and living ourselves numb. Remember, the plate you usually clean is often filled by someone else. The tales we were taught played on guilt. If you don't eat that, you are ungrateful. Others are starving in the world. You are wasting food. Take that lesson and think about how it applies to your life. By taking a job for granted, you may think you are ungrateful. By leaving a marriage, you are letting down your entire family. I think the clean plate concept we were raised on is a disaster. I think we should encourage our children to join the Dirty Plate Club instead. To stop eating when they are full, even if there is food left on the plate. And to understand that it's okay to walk away. Once upon a time, as recently as 40 or 50 years ago in this country, food was relatively expensive. Many families struggled, and few folks regularly ate out. Portion sizes have gone up 30% in the last 30 years, but our appetites have not. Nonetheless, obesity statistics have skyrocketed along with these increases in portion sizes. Food is no longer a rare commodity, though in our society, healthy food is. I understand waste is looked poorly upon, and I try to economize and stretch my pennies just like you. But eating food on your plate just because it is there has much more costly implications than the price of the 15 noodles and quarter of a piece of burger you toss into the garbage can. Obesity and being overweight can cost you and your children their lives. These costs can and will include medication and doctor's bills and the toll on your psyche, all of which is more expensive than the food you're tossing. Wasting food in the short term may buy you health in the long term. I will teach you about gatekeeping so that when you are buying groceries or making meals, you can attempt to limit waste. But when someone else is filling that plate, let go of your old scripts about waste if you want to get control of your waste. New rule. When you're full, walk away and join the Dirty Plate Club. Dirty Plate Challenges. We don't leave food on the plate because we feel guilty. We are wasting money. There are starving children elsewhere. Or it's an insult to the chef. The why. These new rules are a retelling of old ones and require you to cast aside simple teachings and listen to your inner voice. However, the original golden rules are in your DNA and almost feel like reflexes. This isn't just an internal shift. It's an external shift, a new way of being in the world. These rules scramble our spider senses because we were taught them at such a young age. They're mantras that often force us to deny our instincts. We started learning a lot of them for the sake of safety. Don't run in the streets. Be home before dark. Don't talk to strangers. Interestingly, many kids would have found the safety stories on the basis of instinct and spider senses. The bulk of these golden rules are rules of order, a way to make the lives of the rule makers easier. The golden rules and fairy tales actually channel the stakeholders and play upon our fears to tamp down our spider senses. The golden rules are almost reflexive spider sense scramblers because their roots run deep. When our spider senses steer us away from conventional wisdom, the golden rules can throw us. The now. Step 1. Take out your journal and create a section called Golden Rules. Try to figure out the golden rules that most impact you and make a note of them. This could involve remembering stories told to you by grandparents, stories you read, parables shared as part of your religious community as a child, or even stories you choose to read to your children now. You can simply make a note of the title of the story or write a brief summary of it. Also, reflect on social, cultural, or religious rules of order you were raised on. Step 2. Make a note of how the golden rules you listed have impacted your life's decisions. Reflect on whether just relying on the golden rules, even if they made the outcome less than optimal, simply made the decision-making easier at that time. Sometimes the golden rules make things simple right out of the gate and require us to take less responsibility, and that is why we often fall back on them. Think about some big-ticket decisions and then write down a few in your journal. What rules did you break or abide by? What was the outcome in each case? Your life is not a movie. While the golden rules came to us in childhood, we now know that they still have a current effect. That said, golden rules still come to us, albeit not as powerfully. Think about how you have been affected by films or television programs that you have recently seen. One of my favorite movie lines is from Sleepless in Seattle, where the best friend utters, "That's your problem, the movies. You don't want to be in love. You want to be in love in a movie." It's a great line, because many of us want the soft-scripted and unreasonable ideal loves and lives depicted on the big screen. Make a list of the movies, television shows, and books that influence you and your spider senses. Make a note of how they do this, and how they create the rules you want to live by. These books, films, and TV shows may also be driving a grandiose fantasy life. Perhaps you aspire to live a lifestyle like that portrayed on a reality show, or stare agog at royal weddings. Think long and hard about this, because while you wait for some unrealistic fantasy, it's a bit like numbing yourself from real life. On the other hand, these internalized messages may not all be bad, and they may be congruent with your spider senses. The key here is to be aware of how outside cultural influences shape you and your spider senses. Think about how these films, programs, and books are currently impacting your choices and how you think about your life. A very fun add-on here is to have a film festival of your own, where you bring together friends who share the film that has most influenced them and discuss why that is. How much have the actions of the characters in the film impacted your spider senses? Remind yourself that the characters are part of a script, and it is fiction. Not only may it give you tremendous insight into your friends, but it may also give them a new perception of you, and allow for all of you to discuss and reflect on how films and or TV actually influence the choices you make now. Good, bad, and indifferent. Each day, before you make a decision, think about whether the golden rules are factoring into your decision. Take a moment to breathe and let your spider senses flow, and determine whether you are making better decisions by not allowing golden rules, both new and old, to dictate your choices and actions when you know better. Check-in. Golden rules. Break one of your golden rules each day in a way that honors your spider senses. Leave a dirty plate. Talk before you raise your hand. Say hello to a stranger. Take a chance. Be proud of yourself and say it out loud. Don't just break rules to break rules, but trust your gut and your judgment. Make a mental note each day of how it turns out for you and how it feels afterwards. Chapter 4. Conquering Fear. Fear makes come true that which one is afraid of. Viktor Frankl. Jill's mother's simultaneous fear of weight gain and fear of her daughter's burgeoning beauty set the tone in the household. The mother had frequent extramarital affairs, and the loud fights between her parents about these indiscretions filled the house with more fear. There was nowhere to escape from it. Being thin, slender, and blonde made it easy for Jill to meet men during adolescence and young adulthood, but fear about men's reactions to her beauty would often lead to eating. Jill's mother would chide her for not prettying herself up while attempting to compete with her. Over time, managing weight and fears about food led Jill to out-of-control binges and then bouts of vomiting. This binge-purge pattern would be punctuated by periods of restriction. Over time, the numbness that eating brought won out. It numbed anxiety, fear, exhaustion, and the demands of a grueling work schedule. When Jill reached 300 pounds, still as luminous as ever, but carrying an unhealthy weight, it was time to start excavating through her story to get to the root of the fears, and ultimately, the eating. The pattern revealed itself. When the old fears and new fears ballooned, fears about family, fears about failure, fears about letting others down, the binges hit. This patient's story brings home the point of fear because it illustrates the many places fear comes from. In her case, Jill's fears stemmed from watching her mother and her parents' relationships, along with anxiety about her own sexuality, about gaining and losing weight, and a general fear of food. In the midst of that, just picking up a cookie starts to feel like a horror film.